shows that we must know that what we have is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And this knowing and confession to it pleases God. And Allah is satisfied with our knowledge of His blessings. Okay, for now, let's go for a short break and we will be back in no time.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspect of our life.
Okay, welcome back, dear audience. You're listening to Lantern from Arab English Radio, and we are talking about gratitude to others and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as one of the most beautiful characteristics that a person can have. Well, gratitude towards others is gratitude towards Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala as well. It has been brought to us through narrations quite frequently that anyone who is not thankful of the created is not thankful to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. All of us might have heard that this famous narration. مَنْ لَمْ يَشْكُرِ الْمُنْعِمْ مِنَ الْمَخْلُوقِينَ لَمْ يَشْكُرِ اللَّهِ عَزَّ وَجَلْ. If the blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala are spent in a way contrary to the rights in which it must be spent in, that shows ingratitude and is the foundation of blasphemy. If you are thankless, or as in another ayah, those who exchange the bounty of God with unthankfulness are those who exchange the blessings from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala into blasphemy. For now, we have to end our program, and until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
ألا بذكر الله تطمئن القلوب.
This is Gaza Under Attack, coming to you from the British capital, London. Thanks for tuning in. Stay with us for the next half hour for analysis of the different aspects of the ongoing Israeli genocidal campaign in the Gaza Strip and other regional developments. First off, let's bring you up to speed with the latest developments. Day 90, more U.S. Europe-backed Israeli strikes pound civilian areas in Gaza. More than 22,300 Palestinians have been killed in relentless Israeli shelling in the past 3 months. Occupation soldiers have killed at least one Palestinian in overnight raids in the occupied West Bank. To the north, the leader of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement warns Israel would pay a heavy price for starting any war on his country. The warning came after the killing of a Hamas leader in Beirut. Iran promises a harsh response after at least 84 people are killed in bomb blasts at a ceremony marking the fourth anniversary of the assassination of a top anti-terror commander. South Africa files a case against apartheid Israel at the International Court of Justice. Can that stop the slaughter in Gaza? And the EU foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, warns the entire Middle East might end up in flames if the tragedy in Gaza doesn't end soon. Will that have any impact on European support for the Israeli regime? Joining me to discuss those questions and more in the studio is Dr. Matthew Alford, author, filmmaker, and lecturer of politics, languages, and international studies at the University of Bath, and via Skype from Johannesburg, South Africa, Naeem Jinnah, the executive director of the Johannesburg-based Afro-Middle East Center. His research areas include the geopolitics of the MENA region, security studies, and South African and African politics. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here. Let's kick things off with you, Matthew. We're at the three-month mark, but what I want to ask you is how you think the media coverage of this unfolding genocide has changed. We've gone from the tale of the 40 beheaded, burnt babies to Israel's refusal to allow journalists, international investigators into the Gaza Strip to today, where we see it all continuing relentlessly.
Well, maybe there's been a slight change, perhaps a slight improvement. Do I have to come on television and the first thing I say is I condemn Hamas? Do I have to do that at the beginning of everything? I guess maybe not now. So perhaps there's been an opening up of discourse a little bit. I mean, when I was last here on this sofa, which I think was in November of last year, we were talking about the possibility and the assumption, the collective assumption that I think we all had, that this conflict would wind up in December. And I remember talking to you specifically about it, saying, but what happens if it doesn't? What happens if they want to carry it on into early next year? And that's when there's this real possibility for escalation. That's what's happened. I mean, the worst, not the worst case quite, but near to the, right near to the worst case scenario has happened, with Israel now talking about a war lasting all year as well. Presumably that will, they intend that to slightly tail off towards the end. But you know, we were talking about December 2023 for this to finish, not December 2024. What will happen in terms of the media coverage? Of course, it will it will become more balanced and also shift against Israel over time.
Is that because of the sheer number of people who have been murdered, the brutality, the disproportionality of the Israeli genocide?
You can never have something as one-sided for as long. Eventually, facts catch up with ideology, and facts catch up with fiction. It's the same thing. If you remember back to the Nord Stream oil pipeline bombing in the middle of 2022. At the beginning, there was total silence on that. And the reason there was total silence was, you know, basically everyone knew that NATO did it, probably with Ukraine, but everyone kind of wanted to blame Russia. And then after 2 or 3 months, there was more coverage of, oh, well, it happened, it's important, but maybe Russia did it. And then eventually it took about 6 months, 9 months before before reality caught up. It's the same kind of pattern we have in a lot of wars, a lot of really good reporting, a lot of good academic work and coverage comes out after about a year. But that's the problem. You've always got this year-long window where there's an absolute disaster happening before civil society can really kick in with the sort of untouchable factual content.
Well, we've seen civil society, of course, express themselves in the form of protests in the streets of London and capitals across the Western world and the rest of the world. And then we've seen countries take concrete, direct action to try and put an end to this. One country that's done it is South Africa and its experience with apartheid. And that actually is the question I want to first put to our Skype guest, Naeem. And Naeem, the significance of South Africa's move to report Israel to the ICJ, that Israel is not a member of, but I understand Israel is a party to the Genocide Convention, and so it might be held accountable moving forward.
No, all UN member states are members of the statute of the ICJ. It's not like the ICC. Both Israel and South Africa are, and both are signatories to the Genocide Convention. The significance, I mean, there's a few significances. One is, of course, that it's South Africa that's doing it, which symbolically is not legally, but symbolically is significant. But more importantly, that the application that South Africa has put in, 84 pages of it, really reads as you know, a very great indictment on humanity. I mean, it pulls together all of these actions that Israel has undertaken over almost 3 months, it pulls together all of the genocidal statements and statements of intent that have been made by Israeli politicians, etc., over the past 3 months, and presents that to the court as evidence that there is a genocide taking place. I think from that perspective, what it's doing is compiling and making a case for the kind of intention that Israel, I mean, many of us believe, has always had, but certainly in the past few months has. And then thirdly and finally, if I just want to say that I think that it's also significant in that at a political or diplomatic level, despite the fact that the General Assembly has overwhelmingly called for a ceasefire for Israel to stop its bombing, you know, the United States has held that whole diplomatic process to ransom through the Security Council. What South Africa is now doing is saying that let's take the legal route. This is a route that at this stage, at least, the United States cannot stop.
Exactly. And we perhaps can discuss that even further a little later on. But for now, the European Union's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, has urged calm after the assassination of senior Hamas leader Saleh Hariri in a strike in Beirut that killed the most senior resistance leader since the bombardment of Gaza started 3 months ago. Borrell said, and I quote, "The risk that what happened in 2006 can happen again, an open war, unfortunately, is a risk that is not insignificant." He was, of course, referring to the month-long war between Israel and Lebanon in 2006. Here's more.
"The risk that what happened in 2006 can happen again, an open war, unfortunately, is a risk that is not insignificant. And what happened yesterday with the death of one of the leaders of Hamas is one more factor that can escalate the conflict. I had and still have a scheduled trip to the Middle East starting in Lebanon. I hope this trip can still go ahead because it's very important to be in touch with the Lebanese government and the Jordanian government and the Arab countries to explore paths for solutions for the conflict in Israel and Palestine. But we don't know how the situation will be regarding the Lebanese airspace tomorrow."
EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell there. Matthew, your takeaway from what we heard, your reaction to Josep Borrell's comments.
Well, I don't mean to be alarmist, but I think going back to the 2006 war is one thing, but it could be a lot worse than that if it does really bring in Iran. I think there are a lot of other points of conflict in Syria and in Iraq at the moment as well that make it different and perhaps more explosive than the 2006 situation, as well as a very volatile situation in the United States where we just don't know who's going to be in. Really strong ideologues on part of Israel. And if Trump does get in the United States in November of this year, we don't really know what he's going to do. He seems to hate Benjamin Netanyahu. He seems to be more of an isolationist on foreign policy, but he's also very unpredictable and erratic. And in fact, he was the person that ordered the assassination of General Soleimani 4 years ago, which has had ramifications even just the last few days. So I think that a war with Lebanon does sound possible, very possible, but I'm worried about the whole region going up in flames, frankly, and I really hope and pray that does not occur. But if we're looking at a year of Israel off the handle with those kind of public statements, talking about hundreds of thousands of people or even millions of people as animals with a plan to send them into the Sinai, it is, this year is so unpredictable that I just think, I don't think we should make comparisons to 2006. I think we need to put a brake on it for all reasons and all reasons now.
Naeem, what Josep Borrell also has said is, in his words, "I believe that we have to, that we have learned in these 30 years that the solution has to be imposed from outside because the two parties will never be able to reach an agreement," he told an event in Lisbon recently, "and that if this strategy doesn't end soon, this tragedy rather, the entire Middle East may end up in flames. What do you make of those comments, that a solution has to be imposed on Israel and the Palestinians?
Let's remind ourselves that this Borrell is the same guy who not too long ago referred to all of you in Europe as living in a garden and all of us in the global south as living in jungles. So I don't have great respect for anything that he says. But also his sudden concern now about what is happening and the possibility of an escalation. Why? He's not really concerned about Lebanese lives or Palestinian lives. He's concerned about Israeli lives. And perhaps an explosion in that region, I'm sorry to differ with you, Matthew, but perhaps an explosion is what is required. The notion that a solution needs to be imposed, it's foreign imposition by the likes of Borrell, Europeans and Americans, that have led to what we are looking at now. This genocide can only take place because it has been supported by the United States and, frankly, by Europe, despite recent kind of proclamations of concern, as he is now issuing. 75 years of occupation could only have taken place because of Britain and because of Europe and because of the United States and the global north. 17 years of siege on Gaza could only have taken place with their support, with the European Union's support, the same organization that he is a policy chief of. They have enabled this genocide. They have encouraged this genocide. And so when he expresses concern now, I frankly don't care about his concern. I'd be very happy if senior politicians in Israel were taken out right now. And that sounds violent, and it is, because that is what is required. Otherwise, we're going to see a genocide continuing. So, no, I don't care about what Borrell and his associates have to say, frankly.
Take it with a pinch of salt, at least. The Israeli ambassador, Matthew, to the UK, a person who doesn't believe in any kind of solution, so it seems, was talking to UK radio as early as today, I guess, saying, essentially, calling for all of Gaza to be razed to the ground. And she's not the only person who has done it, as we all know. Watch Israel's I-24, and you will see that language all the time, citing Japan, the nuking of Japan by the Americans, Hong Kong, previously Dresden during World War. Clearly, there is no attempt to spare the non-combatants.
And that's a diplomat. That's someone being diplomatic. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a crazy situation. I think to compare, there have always been atrocities in war, and the bombing of firebombing of Dresden and the nuclear destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were obviously we might well consider them at the time and indeed looking back as necessary evils, but it still doesn't stop the fact that they were war crimes as well. And also in the case of Nagasaki, it was not necessary. So as much as we might sympathise with the leaders for doing these horrible things and say, well, it's part of the situation then, it was the Second World War, what do you expect? We still have to call out that for being illegal, for those actions being illegal, in the same way that we can all be sympathetic with all sides at any point during a violent situation. Mm-hmm. But I think it's incumbent upon us to really to pull back from that. And to try and see those opportunities for peace.
All right. Well, it's just a quick reminder to people who might have just tuned in. You're watching Gaza Under Attack, where we unpack some of the biggest talking points emerging from the Israeli genocide in blockaded Gaza. In the wake of warning by the UN of a public health disaster in Gaza, where even urgent medicine has not been able to get through, we spoke to Dr. Hussein Karim, an emergency medicine physician in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, and asked him how doctors like him were coping watching the medical calamity unfold in the besieged coastal enclave.
I am an emergency physician by profession in a novel and evolving field in my country, in emergency medicine. And every day we battle with trauma and with accidents and with emergencies of all sorts. Currently, I'm actually horrified. I'm flabbergasted as a medical professional to see and hear about the attacks, that have happened on Al-Shifa Hospital, on Ratisi, Nasser Pediatric Hospital, Quds Hospital, all the others in Gaza. And they have killed so many people in all these hospitals, including healthcare personnel, as well as people who are sick and wounded. And premature babies, newborn babies on life support have been dying. There have been power cuts, fuel, oxygen supply is not available. Over the last 36 days, around a month plus, there have been so many attacks, more than 140 attacks on healthcare in Gaza. And honestly speaking, as a medical professional, I can only just imagine the situation of where you're working long hours in a hospital without proper equipment, without the resources, without the availability of any support, any help, any aid. And people are just dying left, right, and center. I can imagine the fear, I can imagine the rage, the grief, and the helplessness echoed in the few text messages that were able to get through from the medical professionals in Gaza, saying that we are alone now, there is no one to help us. There have been some inspirational figures in the health professionals, like, for example, Dr. Alo, who was the last nephrologist present in one of the hospitals there, who refused to believe that his life was more important or more worth than the people of Gaza and the people of Palestine, and refused to leave and to migrate south. I think these attacks on medical facilities and on these civilians are absolutely unacceptable, and they are a violation of the international humanitarian and human rights law and conventions. After World War II, there was a Geneva conference where the entire United Nations sat down and made statements and made a law in line with the Geneva Convention and the Hippocratic Oath that hospitals should not be attacked even in a war zone. But time and again, we saw it in Syria and in Rwanda and in Central Africa and in Yemen and in so many other wars that hospitals end up becoming, they end up becoming targeted areas for attack. And this is inhumane because even according to the international humanitarian law, a hospital should not be attacked for both sides, regardless of which party is in it. But of course, it's all a ruse, because what is going on in Gaza and what's going on in Palestine right now is complete genocide, and it's a wipeout. Because when you start targeting the wounded and the ill and the sick, and you cut off all supply of all resources, on a personal level, I cannot imagine the situation going on right now with people dying left, right, and center because of the inavailability of the most basic healthcare and the most basic requirements, you know, to deal with the emergencies and to deal with other conditions.
The humanitarian situation in Gaza continues to deteriorate. The UN spokesperson for Secretary General Antonio Guterres has told reporters that the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs is warning that Gaza is a public health disaster in the making. Health agencies also say that recent mass displacements are fueling disease outbreaks, which could lead to thousands more deaths.
OCHA has warned that Gaza is a public health disaster in the making, and recent mass displacement across southern Gaza is fueling disease outbreaks. More than 400,000 cases of infectious diseases have been reported since October 7th, with some 180,000 people suffering from upper respiratory infections. There have also been more than 136,000 cases of diarrhea reported. Half among children are under the age of five. Humanitarian partners continue to address the critical lack of hygiene and safe drinking water in Gaza, despite ongoing challenges to response efforts. We and our humanitarian partners have been unable to deliver urgently needed life-saving humanitarian assistance north of Wadi Gaza for 3 days due to access delays and denials, as well as active conflict. This includes medicines that would have provided vital support to more than 100,000 people for 30 days, as well as 8 trucks of food for people who currently face catastrophic and life-threatening food insecurity. Humanitarian organizations are calling for urgent, safe, sustained, and unhindered humanitarian access to areas north of Wadi Gaza, which has been severed from the south for more than a month.
Naeem, let me put this next question to you. There's been talk of a drawdown of IOF, Israeli Occupation Forces soldiers, ahead of a visit by Secretary of State Antony Blinken, of the U.S. to the region. And after the Biden administration bypassed Congress for the second time this month to approve an emergency weapons sale to Israel. What is your reading into that?
It could be a way of saying to the Americans that by the Israelis that they are kind of considering or taking on board some of the mild, I don't even want to say criticism, that has come from the White House about Israel's attack on hospitals and civilians, etc. But the other part of this, of course, is that the occupation forces in Gaza over the past weeks have been getting whacked. The Jolani brigade had to withdraw because it lost such a large number of soldiers and such a large number amount of equipment that it was no longer sustainable to keep it there. It has been pulled out, and perhaps it will be restaffed and sent back in. But the point is that they are taking such losses that this kind of turnaround or turnover in terms of soldiers and equipment is very high. So I don't think that it's just the political angle for why the movement of forces out is happening. I think it's also military. And as much as Netanyahu might say that he wants this to continue until the end of the year, this is a big consideration for the Israelis. How long can they last militarily?
That is a very good question. How long can they last militarily? Well, thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there. That's a wrap for this edition of Gaza Under Attack. Many thanks once again to both my guests for their contributions. We'll be back with more. Until then, keep Palestine in your hearts and spread the word. Goodbye.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
A U.S. District Court judge has dropped most, but not all, counts in Donald Trump's January 6th civil case. The move is likely a win for Donald Trump and his fellow defendants, though the lawsuit will still move forward with the core allegations on which it was filed. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. has ruled that only part of a lawsuit filed against former President Donald Trump over the death of Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick may move forward, issuing a split decision in the lawsuit brought by his longtime partner. U.S. District Court Judge Amit Mehta ruled on Tuesday, 2nd of January, that Sicknick's partner, Sandra Garza, can proceed with her civil lawsuit against Donald Trump over the officer's death after the 6th of January 2021 riots, but only on two of the counts. Judge Amit Mehta dismissed the wrongful death and negligence civil counts against Donald Trump, but will allow Gaza's claim against Trump's under D.C.'s Survival Act to proceed. The Survival Act allows an individual's legal representative to pursue legal action on their behalf after their death. Sandra Garza is a representative of Brian Sicknick's state. Garza filed the lawsuit against Donald Trump as well as January 6 defendants George Tanios and Julian Khater. Khater was sentenced to more than 6 years in prison after he admitted to spraying the police officer. George Tanios pleaded guilty to lesser charges. Neither of the men were criminally charged with Officer Brian Sicknick's death. We are pleased to see that our lawsuit in pursuit of justice for the late Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, who died in the aftermath of the January 6 insurrection, has been permitted to continue. We are now considering our next step options to include deposing former President Trump, according to Mark Zaid, one of the attorneys representing Sandra Garza. The D.C. Medical Examiner's Office previously said police officer Brian Sicknick died of natural causes after suffering from two strokes at the base of his brainstem, caused by a blood clot in an artery, and noted that all that transpired played a role in his condition, a reference to Sicknick's experience defending the Capitol on 6 of January 2021. In a separate criminal case, Donald Trump is accused of attempting to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election, including through his actions surrounding the January 6, 2021 riot. Trump has repeatedly denied culpability for the attack. The American newspaper The Daily Beast has also covered this story. A U.S. District Court judge on Tuesday, 2nd of January, dismissed most of the civil counts against former President Donald Trump and several others for their alleged role in the death of U.S. Capitol Police Officer Brian Sicknick, who died whilst defending the Capitol on 6th of January 2021, the day of the riot. Sicknick's partner, Sandra Garza, filed the lawsuit last January, alleging wrongful death, conspiracy to violate civil rights, two counts of negligence under an anti-riot law in Washington, D.C., and a claim under the D.C. Survival Act. But on Tuesday, 2nd of January, U.S. District Court Judge Amit Mehta, an appointee of former President Barack Obama, dismissed three out of the five counts, leaving only the conspiracy to violate civil rights charge and the D.C. Survival Act claim. The move is likely a win for Donald Trump and his fellow defendants, though the lawsuit will still move forward with the core allegations on which it was filed. Police officer Brian Sicknick was killed in the 6th of January 2021 attack after rioter Julian Khater sprayed him with a chemical spray from less than 8 feet away, causing Sicknick to collapse. Officer Brian Sicknick died the following day at a local hospital. The District of Columbia's chief medical examiner said that Sicknick died of natural causes, but that all that transpired on 6 of January 2021 had played a role in his condition which led to his death. Newsweek magazine has also covered the same story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump has been handed a court victory after a federal judge dropped a civil lawsuit's wrongful death claim filed against him. Donald Trump was named alongside convicted January 6 rioters Julian Carter and George Tanios in a lawsuit filed by Sandra Garza, the partner of deceased U.S. Capitol Police officer Brian Sicknick. Sicknick died one day after the 6th of January 2021 attack, having been assaulted and sprayed with chemicals by rioters who were storming the Capitol in an ill-fated attempt to stop the certification of President Joe Biden's 2020 presidential election victory. On Tuesday, 2nd of January 2024, U.S. District Judge Amit Mehta dismissed the lawsuit's wrongful death and negligence claims, ruling that Sandra Garza lacked standing to bring the claims because she was not married or a legal domestic partner to Officer Brian Sicknick. However, Judge Amit Mehta allowed part of the lawsuit to continue. Donald Trump and his co-defendants could still be found in violation of Washington, D.C.'s Survival Act and liable of conspiracy to violate civil rights. Sandra Garza is seeking $30 million in damages. Garza's lawyer, Mark Zay, told NBC News that he was pleased to see that one lawsuit in pursuit of justice for a late Capitol Police officer, Brian Sicknick, was permitted to continue. "We are now considering our next step and our next options to include deposing former President Donald Trump," he added. The lawsuit was filed by Sandra Garza on 5th of January 2023, just one day before the second anniversary of the Capitol riot. The lawsuit's wrongful death claim asserted that Donald Trump and his co-defendants were directly and vicariously liable for police officer Brian Sicknick's death. Sandra Garza argued that Brian Sicknick died following intentional words and actions by the defendants, claiming that Donald Trump was the mastermind behind the Capitol attack and had incited rioters by repeatedly making false claims that the 2020 election was stolen from him. Dr. Francisco Diaz, Washington, D.C.'s chief medical examiner, ruled in April of 2021 that Brian Sicknick had died of natural causes on 7th of January 2021 after suffering two strokes, having collapsed in his office shortly after facing the rioters. Donald Trump has not been charged with any crime directly related to police officer Brian Sicknick's death. However, he's facing 91 felony counts that include charges related to attempts to overturn the 2020 presidential election and an ensuing Capitol attack. The former president is also facing multiple lawsuits, including a case brought by eight Capitol police officers who say they were violently assaulted, spat on, tear gassed, beer sprayed, subjected to racial slurs and epithets, and put in fear for their lives.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we will be discussing about Islamic upbringing, about children and youth, and we get our information from the Quran and the Ahlul Bayt. And joining us today is Sister Salma Khalfan, a respected Islamic researcher who will be enlightening us on this matter. Salamun alaikum, dear Sister Salma.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so much for inviting.
Thank you so much for being here. So we have been discussing in the previous episode about a certain question, which was, how do I cultivate the love of worship on my teenage children?
Yeah.
And you have given us some very interesting points, you know, saying how you want the child to get more in touch with his creator by looking at their parents. And, you know, and you said some other very important points. Would you like to add on to that?
Yeah, for certain. This is something that if we go along, you know, the lines of these kind of rules, that of course we find the basis of all this in the lives of our Ahlul Bayt, then of course it's without any doubt that the parent will see the results in a child, for certain. And we have so many examples in life also. So one other way is also creating an atmosphere for children to imitate the parents. So when they're young, of course, it's very easy. Like, they like imitating everything that the mother does. When she holds the telephone, even the child wants to hold a telephone.
Yeah.
If it's the mobile, the child wants to. If it's chatting, the child wants to suppress buttons. So in the same way, you see, this is done with interest. If it's wearing good clothes, the way the mother dresses, the child wants to do the same things in front of the mirror, for example. If the father is interested in, like, for example, reading a newspaper with interest, the child would also, the boy would also like doing it. If he likes driving a car, for instance, the child will also get these interests.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's not as if that worship interest wouldn't come. It's a very far-fetched thing. No, this is just a misguidance that people say that I do it, but my child does not do it. But this, the way to do it is very important. We leave out the fact that how do you do it? If you do something like you eat some food without any interest, so you think the child will like that food? Say that my father eats it with, you know, with without any interest. He doesn't like the taste of it. So I don't want to try it, right?
True.
So in the same way, if you do it with interest, then there's a secret you're missing. The child will feel that there's something that I'm missing. So in the same way, when the parents do the worship in such a beautiful way, like, for example, the father is waiting for the azan to come so that he can go to the mosque maybe 5 minutes earlier. So the child will feel that there's something here. He will get that good habit in him or her also. So we should now, at first, of course, leave these grounds open for them to imitate their child. For example, a parent, she should not get frustrated, for example, if the child wants to come and do sajda in the same sajdaga that the mother or the father does.
Oh, yeah.
So she should not push away the child. You know, by pushing away the child will have a bad feeling of that moment.
True.
But if she doesn't do anything, or she just maybe, you know, pats the child slowly in the back, the child will feel even, you know, that he's disturbing maybe the parent, and he will also feel that this is a very beautiful thing because my mother patted me on the back.
Yeah.
If you find many examples like this, you know.
I think that moment where a child comes in between the person praying, it's how you deal with them is very important. Like, I think I'd seen at times people really brush away their children, and therefore they're not creating that kind of, you know, nice environment, that love that is created. So we're just going to pause briefly and we'll resume in a moment.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
So welcome back to IRIB English Radio. And we have been discussing about how to cultivate this love of worship. And you have been telling us how to, you know, start when from when they are children. And
that's right.
Then, you know, bring it, inshallah, that way the child, when he grows up, he will want to do it on his own.
Yeah.
So do you have anything else to tell
yes,
us?
Yes, the point I was talking about is that imitating atmosphere should be left open.
Yes.
Why is because, you know, the first stage of building a personality in a child is self-perception. They should realize that they, what are they? So they should experiment and do those things, right?
Yeah.
So when they are left that ground and that atmosphere to imitate a certain task, and then they will realize whether they like it or not, then they will continue. And of course, when that energy is given, that the positive energy of, you know, worship, that when a parent is doing it and inviting the child and maybe keeping ready the things that he needs, for example, prayer. Or, for example, at a little age, if a child wants to fast.
Yeah.
So, or imitating a fast, for example, if the parent does not eat, imitating is also so important. Like they say that those fasts that, you know, that are half fasts, that, you know, like for half a time, for some hours, the child says, I'm fasting.
Yeah.
So they should not be made fun of. They should be said that you fasted, but for 4 hours, for example, you fasted half a day.
Yeah.
You're also doing so much sawab in that to respect them
yeah.
so that they can taste that. That kind of worship, whatever they're doing, however small they're doing, in fact, in bits and pieces, because we know this is a gradual process. It doesn't come that, for example, a boy comes of his age and you say, tomorrow now you have to fast, you have to pray. It's very hard. It's very difficult. But it is possible also. It's not impossible at all. But it's very difficult for the child. And it might be that it doesn't give a good feeling to the child. But we want worship to give a positive feeling to the child.
And I think also it's also in the innate nature of a child, and if it's just cultivated well, then it's going to come out. Like I think you had mentioned that why are we thinking this is so difficult? It's not very difficult. We kind of make it difficult.
Yeah, if it's our makeup that Allah has created us like that, that innate nature of ours to have the inkling of Godhead, then how can it be difficult, yeah?
Yeah.
But we put obstacles around us. Materialism, and, you know, the nafs-e ammara, going towards, you know, all the things that are placed in front of you, wanting luxury more than anything, not training children for, you know, self-control. All these things really play a very vital role in the growth, the spiritual growth of a child. So if you want to be able to institutionalize the principle of worship in our children and create this interest in them, and make them look worship in a positive way, that we must use these two solutions. Number one, we must do those actions ourselves with interest, and we must keep the atmosphere open for them to imitate us, especially when it comes to a very young age. And there are other things to add also as we will go along. If there is time, maybe I could point out to another aspect of how to create this, you know, interest of worship,
yeah.
How to make them encouraged in worship. So another point is to create a platform for worship. Now it's like first it was imitating.
Yeah.
Now it's a platform. How do we create this platform? Is to provide this basis of worship for our children. We know that in the narration of the Imam Baqir alayhi salam, we have that he said that what dhikr should be recited by young children, you know, from 3 years and 7 months and 20 days. So there's a very beautiful tradition of Imam Baqir alayhi salam who points out to how we can lay the platform for the children to, you know, practice the worships.
Yes, that sounds
Allah.
Beautiful. So before that, we'll just take a short break and we will continue shortly.
Ya muqri al-khayrat يا مقي الخيرات يا مقي الخيرات
The Prophet صلى الله عليه وآله وسلم said, Honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقي الخيرات يا مقي الخيرات
So welcome back, dear listeners. We have been discussing about how to cultivate the love of worship. And Sister Selma has been telling us about how important it is to create the atmosphere where they can even imitate. And we have to try and do the actions ourselves. So you mentioned about a tradition that you'd like to share with us.
Yeah, we have other traditions also that point out that what kind of worship to teach our children at what ages, for example. Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam says that we encourage our children to start praying from the age of 5 years. And at 7 years, we order them to pray 5 times a day regularly. So at 7 years is the prime age in even a boy or a girl to order them, to actually tell them, now let's pray, you know. In a very friendly way, of course, because they're still not come of age. And then the Holy Prophet of Islam also has said, when your children are 6 years old, order them to offer the prayers. When they're 7, ask them more strictly to be regular at prayers. If necessary, they must be punished if they don't become regular in their prayers.
Oh.
Because this is so important a matter that if they don't pray in their lifetimes, they will never grow spiritually, which is the actual function in life. To actually grow spiritually and to taste the beauty of life. Because here we have not come to face hardships.
But you see, some people will say, but is it right to force a child?
Yeah, but the way you do it is very important, you see. So there's so many things that a parent knows how to do it in a beautiful way. For example, the way we say creating an atmosphere, you know, giving a platform for them, for example, taking them to the mosque.
Yeah.
Okay. Taking them to the mosque. Okay. We have to go to the mosque. That's our timetable, right? And then after the mosque, maybe treating them a good thing, taking them to the park, or before that, doing something very good for them, or in the mosque, giving them, for example, whatever they want, like a sweet or something. I remember when we were small also, we used to go to the mosque and there was a scholar. He used to give us sweets. So we went to the mosque to receive those sweets only. But it became such a joyful experience for us.
Yeah.
Sweets is nothing. It went away, but that experience remained. So for children also, they look at these little things, you see. So to force them in a very beautiful way is okay. Like in a style, in your own creative way. For example, a mother can choose many ideas to tell her child, you know, in a strict manner. Okay, now it's time to pray. We leave everything aside because it's a beautiful experience.
Yeah.
We don't want to miss that. And it's a matter of only maybe 5 minutes.
And I think there used to be a mother who used to go and pray in the room of her child whenever it was namaz time. And just to say that, if you don't mind, you know, I'd like to pray in your room. And the child would always say, yeah, it's okay. And then the mother would, you know, nicely invite the child. The child would say, no, I want to pray, you know, later. She would never force her child. But every time, because of this kind of action, the child would then suddenly begin to pray with the mother. Like, she kind of felt that pull towards it.
Yeah. So, especially like the way you said, I want to pray in your room.
Yeah.
That's like giving a platform to them.
Yeah.
No, my room is just my room.
Yeah.
No, that should not be there. Yeah?
Yeah.
If you want to pray in my room, let's taste this kind of feeling that you feel like praying in my room.
True.
If you want to pray, for example, in the mosque today, we can go to the mosque. If it's, for example, congregational prayers, we take them to an atmosphere that they feel that energy. Of the positive energy of worship, and they will begin to love it.
That's very true. Thank you very much. We had a very fruitful discussion, and inshallah, we hope to see you in the next episode. And dear listeners, you've just listened to IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. If you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en. Under the tab COI, which is Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and other platforms. Inshallah. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters. 9,650 kHz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.